master merchant and fellow student. This is the seventh time I've had the privilege of addressing some of you. The other six times were the residence of your teacher. I had imagined that we should have a building up of conception based upon what has been said through the thought. But I understand that nearly everyone here has never heard me before, and so that is not the case. But to find out, I'd like any of those who have been present at the other meeting to put up your hand. Only about four or five, half a dozen. Among several subjects that I suggested to Dr. Mercer, he wanted to be well to speak upon this very live subject, not only for many students, but for everybody. That which is known as the student revolution. It's significant. It is important, and not so important, that the January issue of Fortune magazine, which is one of the most important business magazines, gave the whole issue to the subject. To outline facts so far as we know, and as much we don't know, it is only a minority of the students who are in a state of revolt. But such a minority exists virtually all over the world. It is found that in general, though not always, the students in revolt tend to come from families of good, superior economic status. A large mass of students who come from blue-collar backgrounds, to use the usual figure, are not contributors to the revolt. They're serious students, anxious to rise to some higher level of life. The goals attained by the affluent are goals which they wish to attain. They enter the school for the purpose of learning a capacity so that they may earn more. They're quite different. They are the majority, to be sure. But there are students who come from families that have had parents, right, everything. And they are the ones that are dissatisfied. They have seemed to find a certain emptiness in the kind of life that consists of everything, at least in the sense that you can buy the money. What is the objective? A search of the subject has found no agreement as the positive objective. There are some elements that are highly noted. I've been fortunate in contacting that part of the revolt, and that part only, in a meeting of Dr. Merchant's residence. I was impressed. I saw and felt a response in terms of a great beauty and sweetness that left me with the feeling of standing upon holy ground. And despite others, that there was here something of the emergence of what is known as the second kingdom. What I saw was a present. But at the other pole, there is something indeed dark, destructive, ignorant. Something dumbfounded and well nigh inexplicable. This I know only through the news. But it leaves one with a sense of being present. What does it mean? This is something not only of the West. It is of South America. It is of Europe. It is this side and the other side of the Iron Curtain. What do we want? There is no defined positive objective as yet found. There is agreement in only one thing. Something must be destroyed. And it becomes a sort of universal against-ness, not an orientation to a desirable objective. Suppose I know revolution. This is very strange. Let us look at the three greatest revolutions that we have known in our Western history. Take our own, that led to the Revolutionary War, during the latter part of the 18th century. Back of that was a well-developed philosophy concerning government. I refer to the philosophy of the political philosophy of John Locke, one that is referred to again and again by Thomas Jefferson. It initiated what is known today as the old liberalism, and which I regard as the only true liberalism. The liberalism that is derived from the word liber, to be free. Not the liberalism derived from the other root, liber, to please. The thesis in this philosophy was essentially that political government at best is a necessary evil. That the ideal of freedom, a man to choose as he pleases and to do as he pleases, is all important. It's the truth. A third, second, any intelligent person knows you cannot step, live, and unevolve humanity to a state of absolute freedom from coercive government in one step. There's too much that's dark in the soul of man. Too much that does not mean well. And one that looks abroad carefully knows perfectly well that the day when we can dispense with all force has not yet arrived. But as an idea and as something to work for, I know none better in the field of politics, sociology, and economics. The ideal where all coercive government ceases to be, and men live together under the guise of goodwill. The model derived from this philosophy of government is that which is attributed to Thomas Jefferson. That government governs best which governs least. Since the founding of this government of ours, we have departed from that tradition step by step until today. We are aware of the coercion of government on every side. I remember when, as a young person around the turn of the century, I knew of government only as some distant thing in faraway Washington, and something you conjured with lightly in the post office. But that was all. Today, our lives are touched on every side by the coercion of government. This I saw a movement right off to the left, whereas the movement towards the elimination of all coercive government, I would call Newman taught the right. This is not everybody's definition of those terms. It is part of my definition. Another part of it is that those orientations which are towards materialism are towards the left. And that those orientations which are towards increasing spirituality are taught the right. Now, as a footnote, I might refer to an experience I had in 1964, when for a brief time we were at Barrow, Alaska, and met the Eskimo. Having already read of them in the works of Patagon, the book called Moonlight of Midday, she became closely acquainted with the Eskimos over a period of 10 years, became a familiar in their home, had the intestinal fortitude to eat their meals and to indeed take the intestinal fortitude. And that had been accomplished. One of them told her, when a missionary once was talking to him and asked him, what were their laws? He said, what do you mean? The missionary said, you must have laws, something written down in a book by which people live. And the Eskimo said, wasn't he foolish? Everybody knows what is right. You don't need any laws. They had no government, coercive government whatever, before 80s came in and took them over. They had very little violence. They had a strong sense of human fellowship. He who had food always shared with him who had not. They could not understand at first why the manager of a trading post shouldn't give away when somebody party told them they were needed. They couldn't understand a money economy. This is a revelation to me. For here was an example of what has been known as the idea of philosophic energy. Live by. In the case of the Eastern people in the far north, I was impressed. Maybe that idea is not so utopian as most would lead us to think. That is the idea laid down by the philosophy back of our revolution, which I think is the greatest of all the revolutions. A revolution really oriented to freedom, as far as freedom can be a political or social idea. Real freedom involves more than that. Real freedom involves advanced yogi attainment. But in the ultimate, not the ultimate sense, there is a sense we can apply to the word, and that is this: freedom from political coercion. This was espoused by John Stuart Mill and by certain other authentically liberal philosophers throughout the 19th century. It is not what is meant by liberalism today. Liberalism today would increase governmental coercion. Liberalism that is oriented to what is known as Marxism, communism, but which I prefer to call dialectic materialism, allows little or no freedom of decision on the part of the individual. The diametric opposite of the revolution upon which our country and our government was based. However, to step over to the second revolution, namely that of France, we find again that there was an idea, an aim, something formulated by Rousseau and Voltaire and some others. And the violence in that case, and the violence announced, was subordinate to the working toward a goal. Also, in the case of the dialectical materialistic revolution that has taken hold in Russia, China, and elsewhere, there was a philosophy, whether you regard it as good or not, is besides the point. There was a formulation, a definite attempt at a critique of what is, and a pointing out of a possible attainment of something which is supposed to be better. And again, while this has entailed more massive violence than either of the other two, there at least was something of a goal, an objective. What then do we mean by a revolution where there is no unity of goal? I don't know. It's therefore a problem. It is very much easier to see wrong than to know how to correct the wrongness without jumping into a greater wrongness. Well, it's not a brilliant achievement to see that there's wrongness in this world. That's easy. But to strike out, simply to destroy that wrongness, without any thorough consideration of something to replace it, is more likely to be a leaping from the frying pan into the fire than it is to be anything else. So this is the truth. Whatever is not has proof that it is viable. That is, that it is possible to live. However much there may be in it that is far from ideal, and there is none, at least it is viable. It would be the easiest thing in the world to produce a condition that was not viable. A condition in which it would be utterly impossible for 3 billion people to live in this world, where at least 2 billion would have to die because of a declining, inefficient economy becoming more and more primitive. Perhaps more than that, if you go back to a nomadic culture where you live by hunting and by fishing, getting what you can by crude means, perhaps this world would support 500 million and no more. It wouldn't be hard at all to start a process that would mean as massive death as would be the case in an atomic war. So, it is not enough merely to be against an evident wrong. There must be serious tackling of the problem of what may replace that wrongness, which will be at least less wrong. However much we envisage an ideal state where life is perfect, it is only realistic to recognize that we move step by step, that there are forces in man's soul that are far from regenerate. You cannot destroy, for instance, violence in mankind until you have destroyed violent emotions in yourself. The outer violence is but the effect of this inner violence. Now I say, tackle that inner violence. Reach the point where anger no longer arises within yourself, where in the face of provocation and insult, you do not reply with the feeling of that. I'm not talking merely about the act of that. I'm talking about the feeling. Reach that point, and you'll do more to bring about a better world than any external action whatsoever. For you have been destroyed evil at its source. Now that is a task to test the resources of every individual whatsoever. And making progress is the best possible progress for better been found in the study of this general student revolt that there are groups that aim one way and groups that aim another. There are those that are listed under the letters SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. There's a Black Power movement. There are others that are oriented to what has been called the hippie life, whatever that may be. It certainly attracts one's attention. I know back in my young days, the young men at least would have been greatly embarrassed if someone said they couldn't tell them from girls by appearance. And yet, that is what is happening among hippies today. Our young men seem to be different from what they were. Grooming standards, I should say, are very less than ideal on that level. And also connected with it is an interest in certain chemical substances that produce psychical effects. I want to speak about this at some length a little later. There is also a group that's radically non-violent in its orientation. A conscientious objector group. For them, I have a great deal of sympathy. But I went that way myself. But they contrast with groups that are extremely violent, that behave in a way that is not only legally, but is also morally criminal, purely destructive, putting up objectives which it's impossible to grant, and they've even said if these objectives were granted, we would put up others in addition and keep the violence going on. That is just as dark as the first class I spoke of. It touched me so strongly. And it reminds me of an ancient formula, which runs this way. The shadows are darker when the light is bright. There is then in the student revolution both extremes. Now I'm not in the least inclined to deal lightly with those who act in a criminal way. I think our authorities have been weak. This has no place in a university, among university students. The university is supposed to be the citadel of the mind. Not the place for the best. The destroyer of property, the arsonist, the kidnapper. And all of this has been part of the student revolution. The dark and evil part. There should be no concession whatever to demand implemented that way. Concession is weakness. And here's the thing to take home. There are those who are in Germany during the days before the life of Hitler. And the same sort of thing was happening in the universities of Germany at that time. Is this the sort of thing that's going to come out? I say it's a thing to be nipped in the bud, or we will indeed be jumped into a fire fully as bad as an atomic war. Give consideration to requests supported by reason. Oh, I would say that to academic government, but be adamant whenever the tool of violence is employed. Or otherwise, you but admit weakness, and you may help advance the day when another Hitler or another Genghis Khan will rule the world. So while I'm sympathetic in one way, I'd be just as stern as a monster with, of all people, the student who is supposed to be unfolding the powers of mind, denigrating himself down to the level of the battle. He deserves less sympathy because he's already in the temple of the mind. No doubt, many of these who are following this way do not know what they're doing. They're following others who lead. There's some dark sign, but there's a hidden leadership somewhere. Methods that have been destructive methods that have been employed in different parts of the world have a disturbing similarity. It's hard to believe that methods so similar could exist without conscious planning. Though as yet it does not seem to have been able to trace or unearth such conscious leadership. It is known that there is a class of perpetual professional students who take minimum hours, just enough, to stay within the university. And as such, have been local leaders. It suggests something conscious. Now to come to the side for which I feel a real sympathy. Shortly before we left to come over to Arizona, a young man came up to our place, which is about 9 miles from town, at 6,000 feet, and wanted to see me for conversation. He acknowledged that he had been a user of LSD and marijuana, so he said he had discontinued. That apparently in connection with it, some doors were opened. He became oriented to yoga. And he found that a serious orientation to yoga made it impossible for him to continue with the use of the drug. Rather surprisingly, he was oriented to Bach in Japan. Western males, you would expect more normally to be oriented to either the yoga of knowledge or the yoga of action. I loaned him for overnight perusing until he came back the next day, a volume of Sri Aurobindo's Synthesis of Yoga, a 1,000-page book, suggesting that he focus upon the yoga of devotion in there. He didn't do that. He said he made through it. And he found himself deeply stirred by the fragments he was reading. The upshot was that we managed to get the book into his hands, but I did not. This came out of the student revolution. Part of the coincidence. He told me that there were in the vicinity at one time about 150 people who were users of marijuana. He himself was a guest of the county for a couple of months at our county seat. I think he can interpret what such being such a guest is. They thought he was selling, he wasn't. He said, he's rather philosophical about it. He had a slightly, off style appearance, but it wasn't unattractive. It was modified, so it was attractive. He was mean. Well, I have become interested in what it is that happens in connection with the use of these chemical substances such as LSD, marijuana, so on, several others, including alcohol. It is well known they produce psychical changes in the consciousness. William Brain, the reporter, was led to go into the subject rather deeply and wrote a book. He formulated as a part of the experience that came from the use of LSD. I had meant to bring that down briefly. The startling thing was, and many of those experiences are similar to those that come out of authentic mystical experience, part of the process of realization. Even an orientation to the ground or the thing in itself, as the language of the article. Something rather fundamental, and to me, it's disturbing. For if by a drug, a chemical, one can open a door that ordinarily, it is said, takes 7 incarnations, something is wrong somewhere. I could hardly blame a person who had experiences such as these described to be very reluctant in giving them up. But I know the power of a mystical experience, and that to turn one's back upon the indefinite enjoyment of it, it should do a deal of loss to your will. There's something wrong. I can tell you without being able to prove to your satisfaction the fact that there is a very serious doubt. And those glimpses are received as they lock the conscience, which is our true inheritance when acquired legitimately. These glimpses are paid for at a price that may well be catastrophic. Possibly even a psychical disintegration. Well, there may be, and probably are, some among you who have experimented this way. I don't want to lead to despair, but I do want to warn one that hasn't gone by. But the danger is great. Lightly touching it and turning away may ease it, may avoid what has spoken. To illustrate what happens,